It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and our topic today is avalanches. I came down to Girdwood to record the show at the Tugetch National Forest Avalanche Center, which is here at the Glacier Ranger District office in Girdwood. And it's like a full forecast office where folks go out and find out what's happening in the snow and then predict it and put out forecasts on the radio and on the internet and keep snow machiners and keep skiers safe in the backcountry. And I've always been really curious about how they do this. You know, I got some kind of an idea of how the Weather Service works with their satellites and instruments and stuff and tracking weather as it passes through. But how do you really forecast snow and the potential that snow is going to come tumbling out of the mountains? It's really a lot of responsibility on these guys' shoulders because a lot of people, you know, their safety depends on staying out of the backcountry when it's not safe. So I came down to spend some time and kind of learn about avalanche forecasting, and that's what I'll be sharing with you today. And to start with, I've got Wendy Wagner with me, who is a skier. She was in the Olympics twice in 2002 and 2006. Nordic skiing. She's a big backcountry skier, and she's found a career post skiing, like post competitive skiing, that is all about snow. And she directs the Avalanche Center here. And so, I mean, do you have any personal experience with avalanches, Wendy?
I do have personal experience, and it started over 20 years ago now, in the early 90s, when I first started backcountry skiing down in Colorado. And I was involved with two close calls. Luckily, they didn't end up in accidents, but it definitely opened my eyes to, if I'm going to be in the backcountry in an avalanche train, I need to know something about snow and avalanches. And I also have an affinity for snow. And I first, I don't exactly know how it happened, but when I was a Nordic skier, you spend so much time skiing in the snow and in the weather that I always wanted to know what makes the snow change, what kind of weather factors make good snow, bad snow, things like that. So I've kind of, not only did I have a experience with avalanches, but also just a desire to learn more about snow in general.
Yeah, I feel like skiers probably know more about snow than anybody because you're sort of so focused on the quality of the snow and how it affects your skiing. But now you've carried that into this other level of how the snow can behave on steep slopes. And there's a lot of science to that, right? I mean, there's a lot to know.
There's a lot of science. It's physics, it's fractured dynamics, fluid dynamics, all kinds of things and all kinds of science go into not only how the snow changes over time as it's sitting in the snowpack, but how you can have unstable slopes and what happens when it avalanches. How do you even trigger an avalanche? And it's pretty endless, and it's a pretty new field in general, studying avalanches, and it's really exciting to be a part of it.
Yeah, so how did you study, or how did you get from skier to like director of an avalanche center who's like got this responsibility? I mean, what's the path?
Yeah, it's a dream come true, really. So I had the opportunity to go to graduate school after I retired from being a competitive ski racer. And I studied at the University of Utah in the Atmospheric Sciences Department. So I studied meteorology, and I was able to focus on snow science. So I did a thesis on snow science and snow metamorphosis.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, there you go. See, I'm the word guy.
You're catching me. I only say that word every other day.
Change.
And today is the off day. But change, exactly. So I was able to have an academic background. At the same time, during my ski career and during graduate school, I had close friends and mentors that worked at the Utah Avalanche Center. I was living in Utah at the time. So I had sort of two reasons that brought me into the ability to be a forecaster up in Alaska. And a huge part of that was mentorship and working closely with the Utah Avalanche Center, working with them, helping with education classes, being in the field, and a whole number of things. And that set me up that when I applied for a job here in Alaska, I was lucky and was selected, and I've been here ever since. This is my sixth season, and just how the cookie has crumbled, I've ended up now, this year, this last November, getting the director position. So it's really exciting for me.
Yeah, it's cool. So this center, as I understand it, came into existence after that horrendous avalanche that killed like six snow machiners back, I think, in the 90s?
Yeah, in 1999.
And, as a journalist, I've been there with families when they've lost somebody in an avalanche. And I think it used to be that people just went out and sort of looked around and said, it looks okay, you know. And now there's an opportunity to really avoid a lot more of those deaths because you really know quite a bit about when it's safe and when it's not. So there's been a lot of change in this field over the years.
Yep, there's been a lot of change in the field of how to predict avalanches. Yeah. But what I think is really the most impactful for the public and people recreating in the backcountry is there's been a culture shift. So there's been a shift from, it's not going to happen to me, I'm just going to go do whatever, wherever. Now it can happen to me. I would like to be prepared. I would like to have just enough education to watch for those classic red flags and know if there is an accident, how I can use my rescue gear so I can effect a rescue. So those are two pieces that I see the community really wanting to know more because people are realizing that people do indeed die in avalanches and it is a real threat for everybody out there, and it doesn't matter if you're an expert or a beginner. It catches everybody because we're all human, and we all make human errors that can precipitate into potentially a big one, and no one is exempt from that.
Yeah. So let me know. Tell me about how you actually do this prediction job on a daily basis. What's sort of the cycle of the day that leads to the prediction?
Yep, so we have a staff of four people at the Avalanche Center, and every day somebody is in the field. And the day after that, they will compile everything they gather in the field. So they'll get the snowpack, the state of the snowpack that day, what sort of weather happens that day, and then they'll get up at 4 o'clock the next morning and write the avalanche advisory. The advisory is posted by 7 o'clock in the morning. So we get up early on our forecast mornings. We're also compiling data from other avalanche organizations like Alyeska, the Road Program, Chugach Powder Guides. And what's really important for us is whenever the public writes in. So we have a place where if the public sees something in the backcountry, they can submit a report, and then we will get that. And that is really helpful for us to find out what's going on in an area we weren't able to get. Because we're only able to go one place each day. And so we do have a big forecast zone that incorporates different, the snowpack can be different in different corners of that zone. So we don't leave for the whole winter, so it's a combination of every day. We know what's going on. We know how the season has progressed. We know if there is a funny business, which we would call a weak layer, somewhere in the snowpack that we're worried someone might trigger a large avalanche. Or in the case we are right now, we don't have those funny weak layers, which is great, but we do have other issues. So it is a seasonal history as well as what happened the exact day and the overnight for the next day.
So, for example, when you go out to do your sort of observations, how does that, and you're going out today, right?
Yep, I'll be going out after this meeting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you going to, how do you do that? You just drive down to Turrican Pass and strap your skis on?
Yeah, so that's a great question. We do that. We also do a lot of snow machining. So I've become a big snow machiner in the last 5 years, which has been really fun.
But not what you expected as the Nordic skiing person back in the day.
Yeah, I would say that's more of a recovering Nordic skier thing to do. but exactly. So for today, for my field day, what I would do is think, what do I not know about the snowpack? And where can I get? Where do I think there might be an avalanche problem? And that's where I want to go. So we focus our energies for where we go that day to what we think is the most dangerous. We're not going to go in the dangerous place. We can get close to it so we can assess it. And is this going to be a problem for tomorrow? So we will pinpoint. Maybe it's upper elevation, north-facing slopes, or maybe it's south. It's different every day. But that drives where we go for the day. That also drives if we're going to go on a snow machine or if we're going to go on skis. And if there's ever an avalanche, we will always go do our best to go to that avalanche to investigate it. And that's really important. And so those are the kind of factors we look at when we go out for a field day.
So what are you carrying with you and what are you actually doing when you're doing this, this investigation or this like study of a particular pile of snow or a hole in the snow?
Yeah. Yep. So the nuts and bolts. Mm-hmm. Well, we can't just go off the road because that's not the start zones. We're curious about where avalanches start. So at Turnagain Pass, they start about 1,000 to 2,000 feet above the road. So we'll hike up there, snow machine up there, and we have a shovel. And we have other snow science equipment, like a crystal card and a macroscope that you can look at grains, because we look at snow grains a lot. So we'll dig a hole in the snow. We get up to higher elevation, and you want to dig where your avalanches are starting. So that's another piece to that. So you'll find a safe slope that is similar in structure to the slope you're worried about. And we'll dig a hole. We'll dig about 5 feet down, and it depends on the layers we're looking at, how far we dig down. But when we dig down, we make a nice flat face in the snow.
So that's like, you say dig 5 feet down through the snow. That's actually quite a bit of work.
It is. But when you're on a slope, you have a downhill side.
So you're just pushing it out. Right.
And you can push the snow. Yep.
Yeah, always picturing a hole in the ground.
Yeah. And if you have a partner, which we always have a partner, there's two of us and we can excavate in 3 minutes we can excavate a hole if we're quick. Yep. Okay. So it doesn't take long and we do it all the time. Mm-hmm. So it can go pretty quickly. So once we dig a flat cross section of the top part of the snowpack, then we'll look at the different layers. We'll actually poke in the snow with our hands to feel how hard the layers are. Because what we're looking for in a classic slab avalanche, that is the kind of avalanche that kills most people, is a hard layer of snow over a weaker or a softer layer of snow. Sometimes these layers can be really thin, the weak layers, so you're not going to find that so much with your hands. You have to look for that and feel it maybe with your bare finger, running your finger down the face of the snow pit. So this is a snow pit. And then there's snow stability tests that we'll do. So we'll cut out columns in the snowpack. So we'll have the face of the snow pit, and then we'll cut with a snow saw or a cord or both a column, and then we use our shovel, and we actually bang on the shovel to see if we can get a weak layer to fail underneath the shovel. And if a weak layer fails, it's kind of hard to explain without seeing it, but if there's a weak layer that fails, we'll look at the character of how it fails. And typically, we will know if there's a weak layer there. So we'll say, I want to go and see what this weak layer is doing in this place. And then we'll do a number of tests. We'll write them down. We'll submit the report. We always submit our reports for the public to see online on our observations tab. So people can go and they can look at these snow pits. We'll do quick videos if we get results. If we do get a layer, a weak layer, and a slab that jumps out that we're concerned about, we'll definitely put a little video up so people can see what that looks like. But we poke at the snow, we pound on top of the snow, we do these little tests that tell us if there is a weakness. And sometimes there's no weakness, which is great news, but we still dig lots anyway.
I mean, when I listen to this, it sounds like there's so much experience and judgment involved.
Yes.
And developing that kind of judgment must be something that takes a while. And how did that work for you? How did you sort of get to where you were like confident they could come in and say, no, it's okay? Because that seems kind of scary.
Yeah, it is scary and it is a lot of responsibility and we take it very seriously. But it does take a lot of time working in the snow. But for me, that's where the mentorship piece and working with other snow professionals for years, watching them, having them watch you, doing it together. Oh, I got this result. What did you get right next to me? I felt that this layer was hard, this layer was soft. So it's years of that culminate to now I have all that experience to draw from. Every day, you're never an expert in this field. Every day we're learning something and getting better at it. hopefully getting better at it. But it is a big responsibility, and that's why we always talk, we talk in probabilities, because you can't say for sure 100% that you're not going to have an avalanche. You'd have to have no snow on the ground. It can be very, very unlikely where you can 99% say that. But it is, it's difficult, and it does take a lot of time. And that's one reason we have these weekly meetings, is so we can all come together as a staff and say, okay, we all are really thinking the same thing. Because we don't always go out in the field with each other. We take volunteers a lot of the time because there's just not time in the day for everybody to go out all the time.
So just calibrating your judgment to other people's judgment, basically.
Yeah. But it does take a lot of time. And all of us have different backgrounds, ski patrolling, guiding, to draw from. So the avalanche, an avalanche forecaster is typically someone later in their snow professional career that has, you know, already gone through the ropes and made, hopefully made all their mistakes, or the big ones.
And they're still here.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk for a minute about how people can use these forecasts. You have kind of a, like a color code system, right? And just explain quickly what those mean.
Yep. So we use what's called the North American Danger Scale, Avalanche Danger Scale. And it's a scale from 1 to 5. And they use this same scale in Europe as well, and New Zealand, Australia. So everywhere it's 1 to 5. And 1 is green, and that's a low danger. 2 is yellow, and it's moderate. 3 is orange and considerable. 4 is red and high. And then 5 is black, and we call that extreme. And we rarely use extreme. That's reserved for events that would close Girdwood down for a week. And that has happened. It happened in 2000. But typically, we're using 1 through 4. And so it's low danger up to high. The most tricky part is when it's high, when it's in the middle. So when it's high, it's storming, people aren't necessarily getting out. When it's low, it's unlikely, people are getting out, not having a problem. But it's when it's in between, when it can get tricky. And the most common time for people to get caught is the first day or two after an avalanche, and that's when it's orange or yellow. And so on our report, we start with the danger rating, which is one of those colors, and then under that we have a bottom line, and that bottom line describes what kind of avalanche, where we think it is, where we think someone could get in trouble with it. And so not only is the color important, but knowing why is it that color? What kind of avalanche is it? Because lots of times they're really safe places to be in the backcountry, but you have to read further down in our advisory to actually pick out, okay, where is it safe?
I would think there'd be a part of, I mean, be cautious. You'd always want to sort of overstate the danger, right? Because then nobody's going to get hurt. But then pretty soon they're going to stop paying attention to the prediction. So it would seem like there'd be a lot of thought, a lot of judgment, in just picking out what that level is going to be.
Yeah, believe it or not, it is really difficult to pick a color and a danger rating. It can be much more difficult than I think people even think, and it's. That's why it's important to read the bottom line. We definitely don't want to cry wolf, because it is easy to be more conservative than not, but then you're not getting the credibility from the users. You want the users to go out and say, oh, this is exactly what the Avalanche Center said it was going to be like. And if it is a yellow day, that avalanches are possible. So it's not surprising if someone triggers an avalanche when it's yellow. When it's green, then that's a different case. You're not expecting an avalanche to be triggered.
Right. So do you ever sort of talk about whether you've blown a forecast or made an error and how to avoid that next time or something?
Yeah, we do. We, in our stability meeting, we have a structure, and we have certain questions we discuss as a staff each week. And one of those questions is lessons learned or blown forecast, or if we didn't communicate very well to the public. So we don't, if we do have a mistake with the danger rating, often that's a weather. If the weather didn't, it was going to snow a foot and it ended up not snowing at all, or vice versa. That's typically when we miss the danger, and we try and talk about that in the forecast. But we discuss that in our danger, or in our stability meeting. And the other thing I like is we talk about, do we do a good job communicating to the public what the hazard is. Uh-huh.
So the meeting that we're going to sort of listen in on is about kind of communicating what everybody's seeing, getting a common frame of reference. And a lot of times you'll have other agencies coming in, and there's some, you know, terminology that would probably be helpful for listeners or for me to understand. Let's just go through a couple of them, like cornice. Let's define, like, what's a cornice and what is that? What's the hazard there?
Yeah, so cornices, a good point. There are a lot of terms. Cornices, they form on ridge lines, and it's essentially where the wind blows from the windward side of a ridge onto the leeward side. And when it does this, the wind will form an eddy. And if there's blowing snow involved or it's a storm, the snow will get in within the eddy as well, and then it'll stick on to the leeward side of the ridge, and it forms these really kind of ornate features that can be, right now, they're size of a semi-truck or even bigger. And you get these big, basically, rolls of snow that are just hanging on top of slopes. And if anyone was going to go to the internet, you could find a picture of one pretty easily. But they can be huge, and they can be very dangerous, because if you're on a ridgeline, you don't always know where the cornice starts and where it ends. And so you're always looking for rocks or it's trees that might be poking up to let you know that you have ground under your feet, and not just you could walk on the cornice. They form so big that the cornice looks like it's the ridge, but it's not. Mm-hmm. And that's how these cornice accidents can happen when people go over it with a cornice. They think they're on the ridge, but that snow has been built up so much that right. It's not the ridge.
Because it would be obvious if you knew that it was there, you wouldn't want to go over
yes.
the air, right?
Yes.
So and you mentioned the getting on the web. Our show today is on at alaskapublic.org, and you can click on today's show, and we have links to the Avalanche Center and their predictions and all, any kind of resources that you might want to check out. So you can find out more. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm at the Chugach National Forest Avalanche Center talking to Wendy Wagner, who's the director. Give me just a couple of really quick other terminology things. Glide avalanche. That's sort of an avalanche that goes right down to the soil, right?
Correct. So glide avalanche is something we've been talking about this year for over 2 months now in a row. And this type of avalanche is not the kind of avalanche a person can trigger. And they're really unpredictable, and they're very understudied. And we hope now we'll study them some more, because we're in a big cycle now. But a glide avalanche has two pieces to it. The first piece is the glide crack, and that's when the entire snowpack is essentially oozing down the mountain. Gravity is pulling the snowpack down the mountain. And a crack will often form halfway up a slope or toward the top of the slope, where it's almost like taffy. When it's warm, you can stretch the taffy out, but at some point it's going to want to break. So that's what happens with the snowpack. It's a pretty warm snowpack right now, so it's oozing or gliding down the mountainsides, and there's a stress point where you'll get a crack form. Because it's the whole snowpack, you can see the cracks really easily because it's dark and it's soil. So you can look up anybody that drives down to Girdwood even. You don't even have to drive to the pass. If you look up on the mountainside, you can see these glide cracks. So every once in a while, that whole snowpack under the crack is too much, and it will actually avalanche. And when it releases and avalanches, it's extremely, extremely destructive. It would be very, very unlikely that somebody under a slope that avalanched would survive. So they're very dangerous. The good thing is you can avoid them by looking up at the mountains and making sure you stay out from under any type of glide crack. And that is what we've been talking about a lot. But it's a very unique avalanche problem, because people don't trigger it. It's the case of you don't want to be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah, to keep your eyes open. Slab avalanche.
Yeah, so slab avalanche is when you have a layer, the top layer of snow, and it can be anywhere from a couple inches to maybe 5, 6, 7, 8 feet. So it's the top layer of snow that's sitting on a weak layer, what we call a weak layer. So if that top layer is on a weak layer, which is almost, you could think of it as marbles, So that top layer is, it's barely sticking to the mountainside. And if someone comes along on their snow machine or their skis and hits just the right spot, they could trigger it, and then that top layer slides down, and it's like a pane of glass or the rug being pulled out from under you. Those are the kind of avalanches we are most worried about, because typically that's where the nice powder is often on top of these slabs. So we are out there recreating in it. But if there's some funny business or a weak layer 1 or 2 or 3 feet down that somebody could trigger, that's our biggest, that would be a big concern. We don't have that right now, but as avalanche forecasters, those are our biggest concerns for avalanche accidents.
So when you say it's stable, you mean that like there's not too much chance of something like that happening. I mean, that's one of the meanings of the word stable.
Correct. So right now at Turnagain, so this
and,
isn't
and we're areas. And we're pre-recording, so that's, we don't want to say too much right now because we'll jump in their car and down there.
Yeah, exactly. So the avalanche conditions can change overnight within hours for sure. But generally speaking, in Turnagain Pass, our snowpack has been very stable, except for these big cornices that are hanging and these glide avalanches, but that's not the case for other places in Alaska at all. Right. And like you said, all we need is 2 feet of snow, and that will change the avalanche, or a foot of snow, and it'll change avalanche conditions.
And what about, I think they sort of the layman would think, well, avalanches would just happen in loose, soft powder snow, that you'd get it going. Is that a real thing?
Yep, those are called loose snow avalanches or sloughs. Mm-hmm. And there's a term people use up in Alaska, especially called slough management, because we have these big, great, steep faces that lots of folks like to recreate on. And when the snow is loose like that, when you ski down, it'll just start triggering a slough from your feet. So this slough, if the terrain is steep enough and long enough, it'll generate more slough as it descends, and all of a sudden you can get what's called a loose snow avalanche. So this type of avalanche is easy to manage because it's not a slab of snow being pulled out from under your feet. You're actually just triggering this loose snow grains, unconsolidated snow grains, and they just gain momentum if it's steep. And they can be dangerous if you don't know how to avoid them, or if they catch you from behind, or if you get tipped over into a little gully, of course they can be a problem in that case.
Okay, so we're going to go into this meeting, Outdoor Explorer today is about avalanches. We're at the Chugach National Forest Avalanche Center, and I've been talking to the director, Wendy Wagner. Tell me who's going to be sitting in on the meeting.
Oh, great. So our four staff members, Graham Prediger, who's a forecaster, Heather Tham, and Olaf Johnston Bloom, and I believe we're going to have somebody from the Chugach Powder Guides.
All right. And so they're the folks, the people you just mentioned, the folks who go out sort of every day and look at the snow and come back and make their reports.
Yep. The four of us work together.
Yeah, the four musketeers.
Yep.
All right. Well, thanks, Wendy.
Thank you very much, Charles.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. So I attended the meeting with the avalanche forecasters at the Chugach National Forest Avalanche Information Center. And one of the discussions that got started right off the bat was these big cornices. And cornices, as you've heard, are blocks of snow that build up on the peaks of mountains. And some big ones had formed. And that's what the team was talking about.
So, Sean, if you were to say, like, how big extra large is that, like, a well, semi-truck?
In places, I would say, yeah.
I would say, too. I was trying to think, like,
It's like a house.
Yeah.
House size.
Again, you know, the biggest ones I've seen, and these are areas that we generally see semi-truck cornices. I would say they're even bigger, maybe.
A double wide?
Yeah, semi-trailer going out double wide. Yeah. And again, in Divide Creek. And we haven't seen any fail, or I didn't see any failure, but there was one hanging with a crack on the ridge
cornice
that was
crack.
Sagging.
Yeah.
They're really defying gravity. It's impressive.
Yeah, I don't know.
Wow.
As long as they can hold on, but we have yet to see a true, failure in that Divide Creek area where I've noticed them to be bigger than normal.
Yeah. From Cameron Wright Cornice Falls, and then our most recent confirmed Cornice Fall is a Kickstep, right?
On Monday, yeah.
That's significant. Kickstep Monday.
And was there something on Sunday up on the pass? The snow machine had a close call, Wendy?
Yeah. Oh, was that Sunday? Yeah.
Saturday or Sunday?
So that happened the day before. So that would have happened Saturday.
Okay.
And that was a snow machine triggered cornice fall that went right at his skis.
Was that in warm-up?
That was in warm-up bowl, correct. Snow machine, it was the day before, and folks that saw it happened to tell me about it that day on Barbecue Hill. Mm-hmm. And they said the snow machine, it looked like they were looking to jump the cornice, like for fun.
On purpose?
On purpose. But one of the guys kind of inched out there, and then the crack or the cornice fell right at his skis, so half of his skis were hanging in the air after that. Hmm. Then he put it in reverse and inched backwards.
Heart rate through the roof.
But that was secondhand information, but you could see the tracks clearly.
It's Outdoor Explorer. We are hearing a meeting at the Chugach National Forest Avalanche Information Center. Another kind of avalanche that was of concern to the forecasters was called a glide avalanche. Very common this year for some reason. And the forecasters were talking about that quite a bit.
Well, the other thing that seems a little bit concerning is glide cracks aren't unusual up here. And so historically, people get used to skiing or snow machining around them.
Yeah.
Because they don't release very often historically. But then this year, it's completely different ball game. Or maybe the percentage is still the same of releasing, but we have so many that every day there's a new one, right, and covering tracks, people's tracks.
Yeah, it'd be great to figure out what percentage of cracks are actually avalanching at the end of this season.
Mm-hmm. I did.
Do a comparison, or have you already done that?
I did a back of the envelope, and it was like 2-4%. And that was just standing at a spot at the pass. Maybe I was on Sunburst, and I tried to just estimate. I counted 150 cracks.
Yeah.
And there are maybe four that had released in the last few days. Hmm. That's not very many. That's a low percentage.
It is, yeah, totally.
But
even I would think bumping this week up, you might.
It might be more.
More.
Yeah.
Just the frequency this week of looking around through all the terrain.
But it just takes one in the wrong spot. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty interesting.
When you were talking about how earlier in the season, right, you were skiing in the library and people were booting up under.
That was an exceptional user day, I think. But there were people on all of the steep runs in the library. And, I think there's something to be said for how long it's been a problem that people are, it's almost like they have glide fatigue.
Yeah.
And they start to think I don't know the right way to phrase it, but yeah, that day, that was January, and it's almost like one continuous crack, but there were a few clean lanes, and people were hiking underneath them, trying to leave the skiing.
Yeah.
Right, so they were accepting that exposure on the kind of the slow up part, and then not really thinking too much about it. I mean, it's on the way down. I was freaked out that day. It was one of those days that we were out there and we were a little bit ahead of the crowd, and then we kind of did our run and we were like, whoa, look at everything that's going on. And we opted to go way down valley towards Kickstep, ski a run without a glide crack, and then just boogie out of there. We were like, this is between the people and the glides, and it was generally warm too. That day.
Yeah.
I remember thinking that it was warm for January.
Yep.
One of those first kind of sunny days, that was why we went there, to get in the sun.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's. I think there's something to it. Just the length that it's, the length of time it's been a problem. People are getting like sort of comfortable, like because yeah. the odds are low.
Sort of,
yeah.
So you get.
In the favor.
Yeah, and then to talk about it every day for our advisory, it is message fatigue and all of good. That was a good video from yesterday.
Yeah. You know, operationally for us, we're fully still in avoidance mode. You know, we've been cutting some of our runs a little bit shorter, especially in places like Johnson Pass, where they're generally above areas that we might have groups stacked. You know, historically, that would be like a pickup. And now we're ending runs in places a bit higher and stuff like that, just to stay away.
I mean, I think as long as we're seeing activity, like you have to really.
That's right, and I mean specifically to this week, like throughout this cycle, it's been a main part of our operational plan to just give those things a very, very wide berth. And
so you guys have that same sense that this week has been exceptionally, like very much glide cycle.
It could have just been a reporting
cycle.
Thing, but it sure seemed like it.
That's what everybody is saying.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and we're listening to a meeting of avalanche forecasters that I recorded last week at the Chugach National Forest Avalanche Information Center. And the final piece I'm going to play for you is where they're discussing the difficulty of setting the avalanche warning level. They have a colored warning level, and it's pretty tough to make that call as to what color to establish.
Yeah, it's a challenge for us because people look and see yellow, but the snowpack's stable, but it's yellow because within our forecast zone there are glides.
Yep.
It's a challenge to fit these problems into the danger rating boxes.
Yeah.
With glides threatening this popular ski terrain and snow machine terrain.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like these are way out in these far to reach drainages. They're like in prime terrain.
Yeah.
And like I wanted to go green over yellow today, but then today really is like the wind
didn't pick
up, and there is potential like 6 inches of snow just for keeping fresh winds up. But it does seem like we could do that if it goes back to
green over yellow
and
keep it yellow for glides at the mid.
Yeah. As long as we're seeing activity.
What if we aren't seeing activity for a week? When you'll drop to green and then we'll get a bunch more activity.
Yeah, I mean, every time we
both times, both times I did that night or that morning, Seattle Ridge avalanche.
Yeah.
The two times
that we went to green.
Maybe that's what triggers them.
that's
And the other day, which is this last one, I was like, watch there be a new glide on Seattle.
Yeah.
Sure enough, right across from the parking lot, you can't miss it.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and I'm at the Chugach National Forest Avalanche Center. And it came down to meet people, learn about avalanche prediction, and just spend some time in a meeting where the staff and a visitor from Chugach, a helicopter operation, were here talking about what they're seeing out there. And a lot of it challenging to understand, frankly. You know, it's really technical and scientific. So now I'm going to talk with Graham Prediger for a while. He's one of the people who does the predictions here. And he also has a role in kind of being outreach to the motorized community. He's a snow machiner himself and grew up in Anchorage. And obviously, a lot of avalanches are set off by snow machines, and they need to be safe. So that's all part of what they do down here at the Avalanche Center. So there is...
there were a lot of terminology here, like the glide avalanche, which I guess is the avalanche that peels off from the soil. It's really hard to predict. Slab avalanche, cornice, which is kind of an overhang at the top of a mountain, right? And I would think a cornice, and in one sense, it would seem like it would be pretty obvious. You should stay away from it, but it sounds like not everybody does, or it could be maybe you could not recognize it when you're up there. I mean, how would somebody get in trouble with a cornice?
Yeah, so that is part of it, maybe not recognizing it when they're on a cornice ridge. Oftentimes, what we tell folks is to stay back further than you anticipate the cornice going and really double that length away from a cornice ridge. So if you picture yourself on top of a mountain, you're looking over maybe into a basin below to a slope you might want to ski your snow machine on. When it's covered with snow, you don't really know where terra firma ends and snow overhanging air begins. So what you want to do is give yourself an extremely wide berth at the top of any cornice ridge. Cornices are notorious for getting folks into trouble, professionals and recreators alike. Uh-huh. And then from on the flip side of that, from below, a cornice is really a pretty obvious thing to see if you're on a slope below and you're looking up at a ridge. You can see a cornice ridge, and it's just a big chunk of overhanging snow. It could be school bus size to house size, which is what we're seeing this winter. The cornices seem to be extra large.
I was really interested in the meeting, all the discussion about how the winter is so different and you see different, you know, characteristics like these glide avalanches peeling away from the soil, which it sounds like that doesn't happen like this every year, and the cornices being bigger. And I guess it's all about the weather patterns and how they affect the land over the course of the winter.
Yeah, weather definitely drives avalanche conditions. With the glides, it's a bit of a question mark in terms of what exactly is going on. But you can't have avalanches without active weather. And we've had a really active weather pattern this winter since before Christmas. We've had very few sunny, clear days. It's been very stormy since before Christmas, with just a few days intermixed with those storms, kind of in between storm days.
So tell me about how you got interested in this work. Where did your perspective come from? You grew up skiing here in Anchorage?
Yeah, I grew up skiing here in Anchorage. I took my first level one avalanche course in Thompson Pass in 1999 with Jill Fredston, a longtime avalanche professional. And that's really kind of what set me on the track. And from there, I moved to Colorado, another snowy climate, and really, it piqued my interest to see different snowpacks from a real maritime, heavy, wet, deep snowpack like we have in Alaska, going down to a much drier, shallower snowpack in a place like Colorado. And it allowed me to get out into the mountains in the wintertime, and eventually I was able to turn that passion into a profession.
Yeah. So and you've been here for years at the center?
Yeah, I've been with the Chugach National Forest Avalanche Center. This is the fifth winter.
Uh-huh. What are the and you're a snow machiner as well, mm-hmm. and it sounds like you have introduced more of that perspective here at the center. What's that been all about?
Well, coming back up to Alaska, it's been a big goal of mine to outreach and educate to the motorized community, specifically in terms of avalanche hazard and avalanche safety. I think we've made some great strides with the center as a whole, and as a staff as well. We're all capable snow machiners on staff. We've got great mountain sleds, thanks in part to some sponsors like Alaska Mining and Diving Supply and Skidoo. They've given us a loaner snow machine every year to use for our operation. And that allows us to get into this terrain that snow machiners are accessing that we wouldn't be able to get to if we were simply skiing 100% of the time. So it's allowed us to get that snow machiner perspective, to check on zones that snow machiners are going to bring observations back out of there. And it just allows us to be more approachable to the motorized community, and allows the motorized community to really approach us as well if they see us in the parking lot or on the uptrack at Turnagain Pass.
So there's this like a culture division between the skiers and the snow machiners. I think it's less now than it was when I was young. It sounds like you grew up in a skiing family and you had to sort of make the jump at some point.
Yes, yeah, it's very true. And I think that culture is blending more and more. There's, you see a lot of skiers these days buying snow machines specifically for access. So the that hard and fast line is definitely blending. Snow machine manufacturers are building ski and snowboard racks for skis now. And you could get them in as an accessory from the factory catalog. So it was kind of a slow progression for me, getting out in high school with friends who had snow machines as much as I could, catching lifts from Turnagain Pass with other snow machiners, you know, as a skier in high school, and that sort of progressed to riding sleds and becoming more familiar and more comfortable than working for the agency, for the Forest Service. And I was able to transition that to this position in Alaska.
So what are the kind of issues that are more relevant for a snow machine community as opposed to a ski community when you're thinking about avalanche prediction? Or what sort of, are there any differences in what kind of information they would be looking for that you would be trying to provide?
Information they're looking for is fairly similar between user groups, but it's worth recognizing the fact that skiers and snow machiners use terrain completely differently. If you think about a snow machiner, they're looking at things from a scale of really mountain range or basins anyway, where a skier might be looking at terrain from just a slope perspective. So snow machiners are covering 10 to 20 times more terrain per day. They're getting into a lot more avalanche terrain than a skier is. They're also moving a lot faster through it. So it takes a concerted effort oftentimes for when I'm out on a snow machine for a day of avalanche and field observations, it's a concerted effort to actually get off my snow machine, poke in the snow, see what the snow feels like below my feet, just more so than just under my track as I'm, you know, moving across that landscape at 20, 30 miles an hour. As a skier, you're moving at 2 or 3 miles an hour. And it's much easier to get those smaller scale observations.
You're just more in touch with the snow, yeah.
Yeah, you're a bit more in touch with the snow as a skier, but it's not to say you can't be it with a snow machine. You just need to make that concerted effort and recognize that skiers use terrain a lot different than snow machiners.
So what kind of machine is particularly suited for this work?
Mountain sleds, really, something specific for riding in the mountains. What we're on are Ski-Doo Summit 800s. They work great for our purposes. It's much more than a trail sled.
So what is it like? More powerful? Is it lighter? What qualities makes it different?
Yeah, longer track and larger paddles on the track. We have anywhere from 154-inch to 163-inch track with 2.5 to 3-inch paddles. It's good for deep snow.
So one of the things you heard about a lot when, you know, going all the way back to when the big avalanche took place in the 90s is people high marking and doing like stuff that seemed like really unwise. And I'm wondering if you see a difference in behavior or activities that people are doing out there. Because I feel like there's more people out now than there were, you know, 20 years ago. So if there aren't more accidents, maybe people are being safer. What do you think?
Yeah, I think no doubt there are more users than there were in 1999 with that fatal avalanche in Turnagain Pass that killed 6 snow machiners. I like to think that our product is making a difference, specifically in that zone. I think folks are a bit more aware. I think there has been a cultural shift with snow machiners. They're more interested in getting the information and the education. In terms of actual behavior out there, you know, there still are some folks that aren't necessarily heeding all the red flags, but I think for the most part there has been a shift towards recognizing recent avalanches or shooting cracks or collapsing in the snowpack, which is what we refer to as red flags, and really an unstable snowpack.
Yeah. So tell me about your when you're going out and doing some measurements. You like just take a machine off a trailer and just head into the mountains, or do you like have a plan before you go, or how does that work exactly?
Yeah, we've got a rough plan. We'll focus on a specific zone, whether we go to Turnagain Pass or maybe we'll go to Johnson Pass or Lynx Creek. So we'll focus on a specific zone, and we'll have some focused questions that we're trying to answer for that day.
Sometimes there's a known weak layer, and we want to see how that weak layer is reacting. So we'll go into a specific zone, a specific elevation band, and try to find that weak layer, conduct some snowpack tests to see how that weak layer is or is not reacting. Or sometimes if it's a good clear day, we just want to see what's going on at different elevation bands and see where people are getting to. And we're looking for other folks too. We other slope testers out there, other folks on skis and snow machines. Oftentimes they have a higher tolerance for risk than we do as a forecast center and as professional avalanche workers. So we're watching what they're doing. We're watching what kind of slopes that other folks are getting on to see how the snowpack's reacting to humans.
That's kind of hairy. And it sounds like you get some reports of close calls and people have seen avalanches and call them in and that kind of thing.
Yeah, we do. We're first and foremost, we're an avalanche information center. We are the more public observations that we get coming into the center, the more succinct, better product that we can put out to the public. So we're always keen to get observations from the public, skiers and snow machiners. Recent avalanche information is great. A photo or even just a quick sentence or two submitted to cnfaic.org is super helpful. Or if folks are seeing real stable snow out there and aren't seeing any avalanches, that's really good information for us too.
And folks can find those links on alaskapublic.org. We'll have the show has a page, and just click on today's show and you'll find links. And we're also going to be putting up some pictures of different types of avalanches so that people can sort of recognize what they're seeing. And I'm talking to Graham Prediger right now, who's one of the predictors at the Chugach National Forest Avalanche Information Center. Do you ever run into people out there and just want to tell them, like, what you're doing is not safe, or just feel like, oh my gosh, this is an unsafe situation? I would think that the amount of knowledge you have would be it being much more than most other people would put you in a position of being a bit nervous at times.
Yeah, occasionally, but it is a fine line too. We don't want to alienate anyone or belittle anybody who might be making bad decisions in the mountains, but at the same time, we don't want to let reckless behavior go unnoticed to them, really. Yeah. So it is a fine line. We do make a lot of public contacts out in the field, but they're always, you know, they're always on the positive, and we try to point out in as nice a way as we can if, you know, folks are, for instance, skiing on top of each other or high marking on top of another group. That's an extremely dangerous behavior that most folks, I would say, recognize that as such, but still a few folks may not. So we'll make an effort to touch base with those folks and let them know that it's bad travel protocol.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the learning curve is significant, and there's no, you know, anybody wants to can just strap on a pair of skis or jump on a machine and head out there. So it's like not like you can sort of count on everybody knowing what they're doing.
Yeah, it's true. I'd say the pace of technology has outpaced the pace of education in avalanche safety. Like you said, with fat ski technology and these synthetic skin technology and mountain sleds that are the technology curve is just climbing still through the roof. Uh-huh. It's outpacing folks' riding abilities, skiing abilities, and avalanche education.
And I wonder if with stuff like the inflatable bag, you know, that is sort of like supposed to keep you at the top of an avalanche, and everybody needs to have a shovel and a probe and a beacon, I wonder if there's any sense that, well, I've got all that stuff, I don't need to worry about the most important part, which is your brain and being, you know, knowing the terrain.
Yeah, I think there is some of that going on. We refer to that as risk homeostasis. And it's the idea that that if you wear your seatbelt and you've got an airbag in your car and you've got crumple zones and all these safety features built into your vehicle, are you going to drive down the highway like a NASCAR racer and, you know, take these chances? Sort of that same idea can transition into the backcountry. Yeah, we've got a helmet, we've got a chest protector, we've got an airbag, we've got beacon, shovel, probe. There may be that invisibility factor, and it's hard to kind of put a pulse on that. And I think it's up to the individual to recognize if that's happening or not.
Yeah, I feel like it's a little bit of a maturity level thing too. As you spend time start realizing you are immortal and you really want to be able to enjoy being back there and having fun and not worrying people and not sort of, and actually coming back alive, and that there's chances involved here. I mean, have you seen do you see that an age thing a little bit and how people behave?
Well, the statistics show an age thing for sure. I think it's males between the age of 20 and 30 or 22 and 32, somewhere in there, they're at most risk, and are the statistics show that those are the folks getting killed in avalanches more than any other age group.
So you guys are doing workshops. I think you're getting ready to do one this weekend, and we're recording on Friday. Do you do them pretty much every weekend, and what do you include?
Yeah, we don't do them every weekend. We try to do them monthly, so this will be our March workshop, and we'll be up at Arctic Man outside of PAX in April. We'll have a couple of rescue workshops going on up there, and what we try to do is it's a real fun field-based format. We teach folks how to effect a safe, successful, efficient avalanche rescue using beacon, shovel, probe, and teach them companion rescue techniques so they have some skills and some confidence going out in the mountains. Still, we'll preach that the best technique is to avoid avalanches and not be caught in one in the first place. But if you are, or if you come across another group that is in need of assistance because maybe their party was caught in an avalanche, then you'll have the knowledge to use the tools that you're carrying in your backpack to effect that safe, efficient avalanche rescue.
Yeah. So what is your perfect winter day? Like if you are out, can go out and do anything you want, describe where you would be and what you'd be doing.
I would be leaving the Turnagain Pass parking lot on snow machine with my skis on the sled, heading into an alpine zone on a low danger day. It would have snowed 6 inches overnight and the skies would be clear. And I'd be with three of my best friends and we'd be heading out to on a day off also to do some sled skiing. That would be my ideal day.
And you must know like all the valleys. I mean, because listening to you guys talk in the meeting, like you know every. I mean, you talk about the different faces of mountains as if you've like totally got them in the back of your head all the time. So you kind of know this territory really, really well.
Yeah, I'd say we are intimately familiar with our core advisory area being Turnagain Pass. So both sides of the highway, the motorized side and the non-motorized side, and into our periphery zones, we refer to as like Johnson Pass and some of the other drainages back there, Lynx Creek and Groundhog Creek drainage, and then getting further south into Summit. Yeah, we've spent a lot of time out there over the years.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like a cool job.
It's a lot of fun. Yeah, sometimes I just have to pinch myself and remind myself what I'm getting paid for. It's pretty spectacular.
Awesome. Well, thanks a lot. As Graham Prediger, who is one of the avalanche predictors at the Chugach National Forest Avalanche Information Center. And earlier on, we heard a meeting that they were having talking about the snowpack and what kind of issues they're looking at and various other people involved. Wendy Wagner is the director of the center. We heard from her at the first half of the show. The producer of Outdoor Explorer is Eric Bork. Our production assistant is Grace Bojean. I'm Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.